Well, it's not exactly my backyard, but not too far from where I am is the farm on which the Kensington runestone was discovered. In fact, it's about midway between where I sit and where all the flooding has been threatened in the Red River Valley, which is right on the border of Minnesota and North Dakota. And about halfway in between is the town of Kensington, not known for much other than the Kensington runestone. And the story of the Kensington runestone has been dominated by the claim that it was just a hoax. It was a myth. It was something that was started by some farmers who, with tongue in cheek, just tried to see how far they could, you know, pull the wool over the eyes of those, you know, smart city slickers down there in Minneapolis, don't you know? But I don't think that's the story. And in fact, when you get down to the evidence, the compelling new evidence for the Kensington runestone, I think you will be a believer tonight, too. We'll get to it all coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, when the Kensington rune story originally broke, it was not local news alone. It was a national story. It was an international story, and we'll tell you about that in just a few minutes. First, let's talk with the guy who's behind the compelling new evidence, the co-author of the book, The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence, which you can link up to through coasttocoastam.com. This is Scott Walter. Good evening, Scott.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
No, happy to have you. Now, you are a geologist by trade. Let's talk a little bit about your very cool company first, because in a way that's how you end up interfacing with the Kensington Runestone anyway. So Monday, when you're not writing or lecturing about the Kensington Runestone, what do you do?
Well, I run a materials forensic laboratory. The name of the company is American Petrographic Services, and started that company, 19 and a half years ago. And basically what we do is autopsies on concrete and rock. And boy, I tell you, when I went to school, I never even heard of such a science, and because it's relatively new. And I tell you what, I feel fortunate every day because it's interesting, it's fun, and you never know what kind of projects are going to come in the door. And,
right. Now, do you have a PhD in that?
No.
Okay.
I just have a bachelor's degree, and I have an honorary master's that was given to me by my professors up at UMD when I graduated. To be quite honest, it was a sympathy degree, and that's an interesting story. But
it's totally cool. I think it's totally cool. Now, but the reason why I ask is because this idea about this forensic geology, the kinds of things you get called on, you're often called to testify, what, in court? You need to know how old this particular piece of rock is, that sort of thing?
Well, there's all kinds of different scenarios that we run into where we're called to testify as expert witness. The reports that we write and that I sign off on are by and large opinionated reports, and we get involved in disputes. Just about everything is a problem of some kind, and they want us to try to figure out why did something happen. But at the end of the day, they want to know ultimately not only what caused it, but who's responsible.
Give me an example, if you're not speaking out of school, of a case that you would get involved with, maybe like your coolest non-Kensington runestone related case.
Well, I think that most people, when they look at the work that we've done, probably point to the work we did on the fire damaged or heat damaged concrete at the Pentagon after 9/11. And although we didn't have to testify as expert witness, the work that we did evaluating how much damage to the concrete and the reinforcing steel was done by the fire ultimately led, in addition to many other consultants' work, that instead of doing a surgical-type repair, you know, fix this column, repair that one, tear the other one out, they chose to just completely tear out the whole section and rebuild it. So that one was quite complicated, but obviously we were proud to be involved.
Yeah, so they would come to you and say, here's a sample of the concrete as it exists. Is this salvageable? Is this beyond use, repair? I mean, what was the point of coming to you for that?
Well, in the case of the Pentagon, what we were primarily looking at was the structural components of the building, the beams and the columns. And what they wanted to know is, did a certain temperature reach the level of the reinforcing steel? And the reinforcing steel encased in the concrete is what gives it structural strength. And if it reaches a certain temperature, the steel uses its yield and the strength is gone. So, and we can actually do that. We can tell you what temperatures are reached at certain depths in the fire by what happens to the cement paste, to the aggregates, and so on. So that was the gist of it in that case. And I will say this, that fire damage was extensive. It was a jet fuel fire. It burned at a very high temperature. It was confined, and the damage was very severe.
Right. But, again, just to show how your work gets used in different ways, too, you look at you have to know everything about all different types of stone all the way down, I mean, to the microscopic level of the composition of all types of stone and aggregates and concretes and everything.
That's correct. And I think, you know, most people that aren't familiar with concrete fail to realize that, you know, over 75% of the material by weight is concrete, is rock, either sand or coarse aggregate, and coarse aggregate. So we do have to know the rock, so to speak, inside and out, and not only when it's in concrete, but also before it goes into concrete, we will examine aggregate sources to check it for soundness, for hardness, for mineralogy. Does it have the, you know, the strength, first of all, to work in the concrete? Does it have the potential to chemically react and produce expansive reactions? And, I mean, it's really much more complicated than people think.
Well, and I just want to establish your background on that, because I think it gives you the chops to be able to talk about the Kensington runestone. And it was because of your work doing this forensic geology that you were asked to look at the Kensington runestone to begin with. Before we get there, what is a rune for people that don't know?
Okay.
What is a rune?
Okay, and let me preface this whole discussion tonight by saying that I am not a runologist. I'm not an
right.
expert in Old Swedish.
Sure.
However, I will say that with the help of my co-author, Dick Nielsen, and other runologists and experts in Old Swedish I've met, I consider myself extremely dangerous. So let's make sure everybody understands that. But a rune is basically it's a character or a letter in the old what they call Futhark or runic alphabet, which many people might identify with the language of the Old Norse or the Vikings. And so runes are the alphabetic characters in the old runic alphabet, commonly used by the Vikings. But they were used for quite a long time, beginning around, I hope I have this right, around the year 2 to 400 A.D., right up through the 17th and even the 18th century in certain parts of Scandinavia.
When Scandinavia finally adopted the Roman alphabet.
Latin letters.
So then here's why I think that's so interesting, too, is that there are, when we talk about a rune stone, we don't run into many of them in the U.S., but rune stones are not an uncommon thing in, what, Iceland, Greenland, Scandinavia?
Yes, there are literally thousands of standing runestones dating back to, well, you know, dating back to 400 or 500 A.D. Throughout Scandinavia. That'd be Sweden, Norway, Finland, Gotland, and even other parts of the Baltic region. There are runic inscriptions that were carved by Viking raiders going back down into Europe. In Iceland, runic inscriptions have been found in Greenland and, of course, along the eastern coastline of North America and as far as Minnesota.
Well, and we'll get to that part because that's really the key here. But the reason I established, I want to say, like, what's the typical size of other rune stones? When something is a rune stone, does it have a uniform size, or do they just, for the permanence of stone, use anything to write in runic?
Well, the tradition over there pre-Christian times, going back to, you know, before about 1066, which would be the latest of the pre-Christian Viking or Norse runic inscriptions, most of them are carved on fairly large stones, and I'm talking several tons up to tens of tons, that stand anywhere from maybe 4 or 5 feet up to 10, 12, 15 feet. I think the tallest one that I have seen, the largest runic inscription in Scandinavia, is in northern Sweden, and it's about 15, 18 feet tall. So they're quite large.
What was it about? What was it about, the 18-footer? What was inscribed on there?
It was, I don't remember what the story was, but most of these things are memorials to fallen, family members, people that died in wars. Oftentimes they were carved to commemorate some important historical event, the crowning of a new king or something of that nature. It was to commemorate typically the death of somebody, carved by family members or to document a significant historical event. That's sort of typical. And I don't remember the specifics
but that's just totally fine. That's just the kind of thing I'm talking about. So there's a pattern. The pattern is to mark auspicious occasions, and that might include the recognition of somebody fallen or somebody coronated or something like that.
That's correct.
And then,
right? Yes.
And so then these rune stones, then they vary in size, but they don't always vary in purpose. I mean, they're about telling a story or establishing part of the story of the people.
In general, that's true. Now, there are examples that you'll find typically later that are poems, and in some cases, and sometimes you'll find inscriptions on other artifacts or utensils and things like that. This something belongs to somebody, but that's a little bit different. When you think of the Scandinavian tradition of rune stones, yeah, there's a very particular pattern and purpose to them, and that's it.
Good. So then, those are rune stones in general. Let's talk about the day that you got a call about the Kensington runestone. You were in the office. You were doing your normal forensic geology stuff.
Yeah, I was sitting at my desk, minding my own business, as I like to say, and I received a phone call from a representative with the Runestone Museum who asked me if I would be willing to perform a study on the Kensington runestone. And I said, "What's that?" I'd never heard of it before.
And they explained to you that the Kensington runestone was this stone which was a controversial stone found in a farm over 100 years ago. Tell the story, if you will, of how the Kensington runestone was originally discovered, according to the family tradition and those people that were there.
Sure. Well, And there are documents in the Minnesota Historical Society that, when you look at them in total, tell a pretty clear story. But there was a farmer by the name of Olof Åman who was a Swedish immigrant who was clearing his property with his two oldest sons, Olof Åman Jr. and his 9-year-old son, Edward. And what he says he did in his letter he wrote to the society is that he cut off the roots of this what was estimated by 12 firsthand witnesses to be somewhere between a 25 to 30-year-old aspen tree. He cut off the base of the roots with his son, and then they took a winch and they tipped over this tree, and they pulled the tree over, which also pulled the stump out. But tightly wrapped in the roots of the stump, right below the tree, was this 202-pound stone that the younger son, Edward, noticed had an inscription carved on it, and so that's the way it was discovered. And then they were, clearing the trees in preparation for farming. And obviously this caused a lot of commotion. There was another neighbor, Nils Flotten, who was close by doing the same thing. He was called over within minutes, and he also saw the tree, the stone, and the roots. And over the course of the next couple days, there were many witnesses that saw the stone and the tree. And it was interesting because, for decades, no one ever questioned the veracity of the discovery story. It wasn't until Åman died that people began to question the story, which I find rather convenient.
Yeah, cowardly. All right, so
okay. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. So there are lots of witnesses. Now, does that often happen that a tree is pulled over and a stone is folded in underneath the roots of the tree? Is that a common thing?
Well, you know, I guess common is a relative term, and I guess it depends on who you talk to. Now, I've spent a lot of time in the field and in the woods, and I've seen, you know, blowdowns, and, you know, you've probably seen them yourself. When a large tree tips over in a storm, it pulls up the ground, it pulls up soil, and it pulls up rocks, and by the, in some cases, large quantities, and I've seen myself large boulders that were tightly wrapped in trees. So in my opinion, it's very common.
Okay, that's good. No, I'm totally good with that. I just, I think on the face of it, it's very credible. It would also explain perhaps why the tree tipped over so easily, that if it was seated on top of the stone partially and the roots were going underneath the stone, it wasn't that hard to dig, to get the tree over, and there underneath the tree is this big stone. And you said that it was the farmer's son who originally saw the writing on the slab.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it wasn't in anything that they immediately recognized as a language that they were, with which they were familiar.
Well, no. In fact, their first impression was they thought it was an Indian almanac, and you know, that was their first impression, and I'm sure the people that went out there, you know, these are farmers, they're not runologists, and I don't think anybody recognized what the runes were. Well, later on, you know, once they kind of got their head around this thing and people began to realize what it was, you know, Omen said to people, look, I was born and raised in Sweden, and I know what runes are, but I don't know enough to use them. And the way I look at that, to me, that sounds very credible. It's almost like, you know, we're all raised in this country to, you know, what kid doesn't know who Christopher Columbus is? So it seemed very credible to me, and he said, but I don't know how to use them. And, of course, you know, his words were twisted, and, you know, people had different motives, so... But if you look at it at face value, it seems quite reasonable to me.
I agree completely. There's nothing, and in fact, it would be like saying you grew up in this country and you can recognize typical Native American cave carvings or paintings on, you know, leather or something. It would look familiar, but I wouldn't be able to interpret it.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. You'd know that it was of Native American origin, but that's about it. You know.
Right. And his first thought that this might be a Native American stone, that makes perfect sense because there's a lot of that in Minnesota, that sort of thing anyway. Could be, you know, an arrowhead find, or you might find something related to the original inhabitants of Minnesota.
Well,
if
I could just jump in for a second.
Sure.
It's completely consistent with the Omen family because we've gotten to know their family quite well, and there were other peoples in the area, and they told us that they found so many Native American artifacts on the farm over the years, they would just throw them down the well. I mean, it was so commonplace, they'd throw them down the well. So this idea that it was an almanac is very reasonable.
And fortunately, they didn't throw this one down the well.
No, they didn't.
Looking at it, so he goes, these are rune symbols. What? Why would that be under a tree? And what is this stone doing here? And we just have a minute before the bottom of the hour. So just tell me, what did he decide first? What did this farmer decide to do first with the rune stone?
Well, the first thing that happened was there was a lot of excitement and you know, people came out to see it, but it was found in September, and this is a very busy time on a farm anywhere in North America. And they took the stone after those first couple of days into town where it was displayed in the jewelry store in Kensington, and we presume that everybody kind of went back to work and things settled down. But a couple months later, when the weather turned cold in December, we know the stone was brought back out to the Omen farm where Olaf sat down and tried to figure out what the inscription said.
All right, and that's just where we'll leave the story then till we continue with Scott Walter, who is a geologist and the co-author of the Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. We're just getting started. Before it's over, you'll know what's on the runestone and why it was there on that farm, and it will all make sense. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Strange behavior from my dog. Also, you can go back to last week's blog on those very weird pictures I told you about. I put those on my blog, too, at coasttocoastam.com. And while you're there, you can click onto some pictures of the Kensington Runestone. They're from the book, The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. Scott Walter is one of the co-authors of the book. Now, Scott, let's pick it up right where you left off. So the farmer, this good old, you know, first generation Swedish Minnesotan farmer, heading into the long winter months, brings the runestone back from the local jewelry store back to the farm to give it a good long perusal. And what does he find as he starts digging into it?
Well, first of all, there were some comments we've read and some comments from people that the stone was packed with mud. And, of course, in December in Minnesota, it gets dark awful early, and there's no electricity in the house, and so the lighting was probably very poor. And what he did, and there are a number of references to this, he took a nail and he scratched out the inscription while he was, you know, to clean out the mud and so forth. And there were neighbors that gave him some books, a couple of them. One was the Rosander book. Another one had some rune rows in them. Some of them had some information about Old Swedish. And he sat down and he tried to figure out what was in the inscription himself. And he, not long afterwards, he abandoned that task. And incidentally, these books that were given to him by some of his neighbors, many years later, these were claimed by opponents to be, you know, the references he used to carve the inscription. We now know that none of these things would even get you close to carve these, but this didn't stop them from making the claims. But anyway, he quickly realized that he couldn't figure it out. So what he did was he made a copy of the inscription, wrote it out on a piece of paper, and then a neighbor, John Hedberg, wrote a letter in English for him, and that letter was then sent down to Minneapolis to a man named Swan Turnblad, who was the then publisher of this, the Svenska Amerikanska Posten newspaper.
It's a Swedish, Swedish-American newspaper.
The Swedish-American newspaper, and then Turnblad, who incidentally at that time lived in what is now the American-Swedish Institute in South Minneapolis. He took that copy and he went over to the University of Minnesota. He gave it to the then professor of Scandinavian languages, a man named Olus Breda. Breda looked at the copy that Oman made, and I think this is a very important point here. He never looked at the stone. There's no evidence that this linguist ever looked at the Kensington Runestone. He looked at the copy and he thought he saw some modern Swedish words. He thought he saw some English words. He didn't even recognize the numbers, something called pentadic numbers in the inscription, and he quickly dismissed it as a clumsy hoax. And I believe that set a very important precedent.
Sure. Now, first of all, we should establish, if you're going to find a rune stone, it written in some ancient Swedish variant rune language, that this is the place to find it. Minnesota is the place to find it, because you actually have people that study Swedish and teach it. Not every state would have a nearby professor of Swedish that you could turn to look at it. But in this case, it actually kind of worked against him.
Absolutely.
Because the guy looked at it and went, oh, this is a clumsy hoax. He's just, you know, he's pulling our leg. So the feeling was that sort of that this, here's this farmer and he just decides to see if he can have some fun with, you know, people by pulling essentially what might be his own piltdown man story.
Well, you know, and in fairness to, you know, to everybody, yeah, I can appreciate that, and I have to admit that when I first started to understand the story, I can remember at one point I said, this is interesting, this is old Swedish, and this guy's a Swede, and, you know, it was an interesting point, but, you know, from the standpoint of a forensic investigation, it doesn't mean anything other than it's an interesting human trait. You have to find, or coincidence, you have to find some connections, some tangible evidence. You can't just say, wow, isn't that interesting? Well, it's interesting, but it doesn't meet the standard of evidence.
So dismissed as a hoax, and here's this Minnesota farmer. He knows he didn't pull a hoax. His kids were there when he found it. They swore that this is true. The other people that came by saw the stone wrapped up in the roots of the tree. They knew that they saw that it was real, but all it took was one sophisticated person with a lot of influence to say hoax, And whether he did it himself or somebody else did it and tried to pull the wool over this farmer's eyes, it didn't really matter. It set down this precedent that said basically it's already been proven to be untrue, and then it's an uphill battle to change that perception.
Right. It was a cause and effect thing. I mean, it was declared a hoax, so therefore, okay, well, if it's a hoax, then somebody's playing a joke. And, you know, that became the focus rather than really trying to establish what is this thing. And
right.
Me, as an investigator, that's one of the curious things that I find kind of humorous, actually, that, you know, the bottom line, and I don't know if this is the right point to talk about it, but really the fundamental problem with this whole situation is the way the investigations commenced and went forward. They were not scientific, and okay. That's really been the crux of the problem.
All right.
Until now, really.
Well said. So I know that we could spend a lot of time talking about other people that came and looked at it, and that there were other attempts to get people to re-examine it, and other professors came and looked at it and said, no, wait, this is real, and other people looked at it and said, oh, it's not. And then there were people that claimed that they had been involved in the hoax. And so there's all sorts of, you know, twists and turns to the Kensington Rune story. But I want to move up the date a little bit to the year that this ancient language, runic language, was discovered. Was it 1968?
I guess if I'm not sure what you're asking, but if you're talking
okay.
about when really the language study really marched forward and the mysterious anomalies in the inscription began to be realized that they were in fact legitimately medieval, began in the 1960s. Yeah.
Okay. I thought there was one discovery of a heretofore forgotten runic language, of an old language, and they had found something that reestablished the characters as were written on the Kensington runestone as original, that they couldn't have known this in the 30s and 40s. They didn't have a model to actually look at the Kensington runestone with because nobody had discovered this language. It predated any of their scholarship, but it hadn't been rediscovered until the late 60s.
I'm not sure what you're – I'm a little bit confused on the question.
Okay.
First of all, the 1960s was when the Scandinavian scholars – and you have to remember there are thousands of runic inscriptions of various kinds throughout the Scandinavian world and down into Europe that the Scandinavian scholars have studied for the last, 200-300 years. But it wasn't until the 1960s that they began to study a treasure trove of runic inscriptions, primarily medieval, on the island of Gotland in the Baltic Sea. And I think the reason is, this is my own thought, is that the reason why they waited until then, relatively late, in the whole body of information was because it was on an island. It was probably hard to get to, and they just, for whatever reason, that was the last place they studied. But it was on Gotland that they found all of the anomalies, the runes, the language, the dialect, grammar, and dating features that are found on the stone. And, in fact, they're still studying the runic inscriptions of Gotland. So there's no doubt going to be more found. But this was really the thing that turned the whole thing around. And so that's really when things started. But Dick Nielsen is really the first person to look at that body of information in context with the runestone ever. And,
okay.
And that's really the thing that turned it.
Well, and so then let's focus on this. So here's this island, Gotland, Gotland, and it's an isolated island. And I thought this was the key part about it. Like so many other aspects of isolation, there are unique features to the language, to the characters of the runic on this island, Gotland. And it was not an unprosperous island. It was filled with how many monasteries were on Gotland?
Well, there's one major Cistercian monastery there, but there are 92 churches on Greater Gotland, and there's 7 churches within the walled city of Visby. So you're talking 99 churches on this island that's about 90 miles long and about 40 miles wide.
All right. And so if we just looked at the language from that little island, what we discover is that it's the same characters that they would have written, they would have used to write in on that island are the same characters that pop up on the Kensington runestone.
That's correct. And you know, this is a critical point because in my lectures, I like to use the analogy, much like biology will evolve differently when it's sequestered on an island. You think about Charles Darwin's work on the Galapagos Islands. The same is true with language. You see unique evolutionary traits in language when it's sequestered in, you know, an island, in this case.
Sure.
So it really becomes quite reasonable when you think about it in that respect. One of the things I've always said is that the geology convinced me that this was not a modern hoax and therefore must be genuine. And therefore all these anomalies or freaks, as some people said, in the language and runes on this inscription have to exist someplace. And it turns out that was correct.
So that explains why the professors that were originally looking at this said this is a hoax. They couldn't have known of the dialect that was on this little island.
It wasn't known.
So they couldn't. It's not to their own fault. They could not have known that when they dismissed it as a hoax.
Well, you know something, Ian, we get into a little bit of a tricky wicket here. Your statement is correct. They couldn't have known. However,
they could have done better.
It did not stop them from making proclamations that they simply could not support.
Fair enough.
And that's an honest statement, and it needs to be addressed.
Okay, fair enough. But I just want to say that it's the idea of discovering on this small island that there were these runic this language existed, and one of the best examples of all of the particular type of lettering was on the Kensington runestone. So now that we know what the original language was, now people can go back and they can read it and read what's actually on the Kensington runestone. So I think this is a good time.
Yeah.
Explain what's on the runestone. What did it say? Now that we know the language that it was, now let's just say what's on the stone.
Okay. There are a few changes, and they're relatively minor in the context of the actual change. But as far as the context of the message has changed significantly, at least in my opinion. But what I'll do here is I will tell you what it says based on the work of my co-author, Dick Nielsen. And there may be some slight changes from this, but this is essentially what it says. It starts on the face side. And it says 8, there's a number 8, Guter or Goths, and 22 Northmen or Norwegians. On this acquisition business, far to the west of Vinland, we had camped near two skerries. The word is, we think, means shelters. It's a point of reference. We had camped near two shelters, one day's journey north from this stone. On line 6, it says, we were fishing. And I do think it's important to, at this point, just remind the listeners that many people want to call this a Viking Age artifact. And we talked about the date of 1066 being when the Viking Age or the pagan period ended in Scandinavia and Europe. It was Christian times. And this stone is dated 1362, so it's not a Viking artifact. This is a Christian document.
Okay,
that's a very important thing.
Okay, you're digressing for no. Let's get into that later.
Okay.
Just read it straight through and translate it as like word for word as you think it would be translated. So just go ahead.
Okay. My apologies.
That's okay. I understand your need to want to be very specific, but we can get into that later on.
Okay,
I just don't want to do that in the middle. Okay.
Okay. So we've got 8 Goths and 22 Norwegians on this acquisition business far to the west of Vinland. We had camped near two skerries, one day's journey north from the stone. We were fishing one day. When we came home, found 10 men red with blood and death. Then we have 3 Latin letters, AVM, save from evils. Then on the split side, it says there are 10 men by the sea with our ships, 14 days journey from this island, year 1362.
Okay. absolutely fascinating. It has the appearance of being, just as we talked about before, a rune stone that marked a significant event. They were fishing, which, as you say, we can either look at as meaning that they were actually fishing for fish, or that they may have been Christians that were out there meeting with the natives, you know, spreading, evangelizing, being fishers of men, or, and what happens is, and they come back and they discover that essentially their group has been devastated. Can you flesh out a little bit what we think we mean by red with the death, red with blood reference?
Okay, well, yeah, that's a great question. And in my opinion, this part of the inscription is the part that has been subject to some rampant speculation and some misconceptions, in my opinion. Now, red with blood and death is interesting. And first of all, we don't know who the 10 men are. Everybody presumes it's 10 men from their party. We don't know that. They could be Native Americans. It could be a mixture. We don't know. Personally, after kind of, you know, thinking about this for a long time, I'm beginning to think that the most likely explanation is that the 10 men may have had plague.
Right.
You know, they could have brought the plague with them when they came over in 1348, 1349. Europe was ravaged with plague. And so we're talking 1362, a little over a decade later. So to me, that seems plausible. And there are other reasons why I say that, but that seems to be the explanation there. And who those 10 men were, we really don't know. It could very well have been members of their party. We're just,
right.
just not sure.
It could have been disease. It could have been a battle. It could have been an accident. It could have been something. But the runestone marks what seems to be a turning point in their adventure.
A traumatic event, yeah.
This is a traumatic event, and they are establishing the news. And it seems to say, talk a little bit more about the ships that are waiting for them. Are they leaving this runestone as a marker because now they're about to head back to the ships? Or are they leaving this marker because they realize their party is doomed and they'll never make it back to their point of origin?
Well, that's the compelling question that, you know, we just don't know the answer to. And so we just don't know. But, you know, when you add up the numbers, you've got a party of 30 people. It sounds like in total 10 at the ships. That would leave 20. And now if you've got 10 that are gone, you still have a significant group that may or may not have made it back. We just don't know. But it's fun to think about.
Okay, and that's just what we're gonna continue to unpack this. What's written on the Kensington runestone, and in the next hour we'll get more specific about who wrote it. Who were these monks? Where does the Knights Templar come into this? And why would they have left it where they left it? I think it'll all make sense when you hear the whole story coming up next with Scott Walter on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about stones. The Kensington Rune Stone, Compelling New Evidence, is the book. You can link up to Scott Walter through coasttocoastam.com. Buy this book. You know, there are lots of books that come out with that would make a claim and present a case, make an argument. This is a book that's, first of all, it's as thick as an encyclopedia. It's not a pocketbook, but it's filled with illustrations, photographs, copies. It's the proof. It is the case for the Kensington runestone from beginning to end. There's a lot here to read. They, if you'll pardon the expression, leave no stone unturned in this investigation, and I think they do it beautifully. We'll get back to just what was written on the runestone, and then who would have been the people that would have been the likely suspects to leave it there, and why there? Why in the middle of this field in a farm in Kensington, Minnesota? It will all make sense next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Scott, I'm going to ask you to read what's on the Kensington runestone one more time. And for people who want to, they can go to the website at coasttocoastam.com and look at the picture of it. But just read again the text that's on the runestone.
Okay. It starts on the face. It says, 8 Goths and 22 Norwegians on this acquisition business far to the west of Vinland. We had camped near two shelters, one day's journey north from this stone. We were fishing one day. When we came home, found 10 men red with blood and death. AVM, Latin letters AVM, saved from evils. On the side, it says, there are 10 men by the sea with our ships. 14 days journey from this island, year 1362.
Now, were they on an island when they wrote that?
Great question, and as my understanding is, the word that has been translated to island in Old Swedish could mean a hill or a high spot of land that is either totally surrounded or partly surrounded by water. So,
and that's key here for why we're going to get into why it's left where it was. So
correct.
I just want to make that point.
Yep.
So again, so if we're to guess at the story, what we know is it's as typical of runestones, it marks a significant event, a turning point. Whether it means that they're turning back to go to the ships, or whether it means that they realize they'll never make it back to the ships, or whether it means that with this group that's suffered this traumatic event, does it mean that they think that this is it, this is where they're going to die, and so they're going to mark this spot for people to come later on and find and go, aha, here's what happened to the missing group. We just don't know.
That's right.
Okay. But now we can start making some suppositions about who the they is, because not everybody would have been able to write this language, not even everybody from the island of Gotland in Scandinavia.
That's correct. And I think what's important for people to realize is back in medieval times, certainly in the 1300s, that to have the ability to carve an inscription as complex as this, you really don't have a lot of candidates. In fact, really the only plausible candidates you have would be members of the clergy who would have had the education to be able to carve something like this.
And so who would have been the clergy on the island of Gotland, where this language very specifically that's used on the runestone originated?
Well, great question, and really there's only one answer. At this time on the island of Gotland, the only clergy that was present at that time were members of the Cistercian monastic order, which was a very large, very successful, especially at that time, member that was a monastic order that was affiliated with the Catholic Church.
Okay, and this was a mainstream group, the Cistercians, very well respected, and they had a unique feature to them in terms of how they evangelized.
Well, yeah, they, yeah, I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're hinting at, but if you're hinting at what I think you are, we're going to get into an area that is very controversial and very important.
Well, then I'll be more specific. They do something which is some churches do, but they had a very formal way of doing it. When the church grew big enough that they had just planted, then 12 of them would go out from there and start another one.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
They would.
So that was their model all the time. They were a very forward-thinking group. They were very focused on what we would call today church planting, and they as a part of their monastic worldview is they saw it necessary to keep going out further and further and further from wherever they started.
Yes, and so and if I can read your mind a little bit, I think this is something I've thought about, the idea of going out into the vast wilderness, which of course has been one of the complaints by many scholars. Who would do this? This is in keeping with their tradition. So there's certainly parallels here that you can draw, or the term I like to use is consistencies with their practice and what the things you can draw from the runestone and who may have carved it and why and all that. So yes, there definitely are some consistencies.
And as a monastic order, Cistercians were completely self-sufficient. Every group had to be self-sustaining. Everybody was a craftsman. Everybody was a farmer. Everybody did everything. They were a hard-working group.
No doubt about it. In fact, they were so well organized. It's really an amazing group of people to study, and this is something I've done. And the more I've looked into them, the more amazed I am at how organized they were, at the uniqueness of this particular order. They weren't the only monastic order. There were many monastic orders, but they were far and away the most successful, and they became very wealthy and ended up having much land. They were really incredible, and I think in history, these people and their charismatic leader, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, are some of the most important historical figures. Certainly, he is in their order that really is largely unknown by most people. It's kind of surprising.
And they grew rapidly, you know, on the tail end of the Middle Ages in particular. They grew, and it's not the idea, knowing that they're craftsmen, knowing that they were metallurgists, knowing that they were interested in hydraulics, knowing that they were always doing interesting millinery work. They were doing all these, that it wouldn't, it's not out of the question to think that they might have been, you know, and they would have sailed. We know that they went from Gotland to other parts of Scandinavia. It's not impossible to think that they might have continued to follow previous Viking shipping lines and gone out into the sea and gone to look for new places to build new churches.
Well, definitely, and there's an element here that I think you're leading up to, and that's the Knights Templar, who were a military monastic order that were founded by the Cistercians in 1128. And the charter for the Templars was written by St. Bernard of Clairvaux, which is essentially identical to the charter of the Cistercians. So when you talk about venturing out, now, suddenly, when you introduce the Templars, who were absolutely aligned with the Cistercians, essentially they were one and the same, certainly ideologically, now you have an even more plausible you know, possibility and set of circumstances that could, again, be consistent with, you know, the story we're talking about.
Well, and that, let's put that aside for the moment and get back to that, because I think that's really key. But let's just focusing in terms of on the Cistercians themselves, they would have had the education, they had this language, they were from the island, they were on the island of Gotland as well as other places, and it was their inclination to go out and establish new churches and to build new places. Have you ever talked to any of the Cistercians on Gotland? Is there any record of them doing this type of evangelism?
Well, no, I have not talked to any Cistercians on Gotland. I'm not aware that there are any more Cistercians there. The only remnants of that order back in medieval times is the monastery at Roma, and that's in ruins now. And so really the order it does exist, certainly, but yep. Nowhere near what it once was, certainly not back in medieval times.
Well, then I wonder whether there has to be, knowing it, as industrious as they are, I wonder whether there might not be a Cistercian historian somewhere that might either keep the record, or on the island of Gotland, where the villages have taken over the monastic records, and whether there is any record of them sending out ships full of, you know, new Cistercian monks, as more and more people were joining the order and it expanded rapidly, whether or not there isn't some record somewhere of them getting provisions, you know, being fitted for a ship and having left at a time that would have brought them perhaps to the New World.
Well, I think you make an excellent point, and I think the answer to that question is I wouldn't be surprised at all. And really what I believe, and I think is really an important point here that you're bringing up, is, you know, if people are ready to put aside some old ideas and embrace this thing and look at it in a logical, systematic, scientific way, there's no question what this is. So if it's genuine, then all of a sudden you have all kinds of possibilities and opportunities for people to go back who have the education, the background to be able to, first of all, read these things and go back and look in the voluminous record that the Cistercians left. And by the way, they had massive scriptoriums then and there are who knows how many documents somewhere in there, probably they haven't even been looked at since they've been written. I wouldn't be shocked at all if there was some evidence or even just a direct record of exactly what you described.
Right. So, all right, now let's bring the Knights Templar back into this. So here we are in the early part of the 14th century, and we know from the historical record that the Knights Templar and the Cistercians are brother organizations. The Knights Templar are falsely accused. They're persecuted. They're disbanded. Their money is sought by kings and princes who are more than happy to break up the Knights Templar so they can lay claim to their treasures. And we know that many of the Knights Templar were killed. But also that many more were allowed to be, quote unquote, rehabilitated. They spent some time in prison and then they were released, and others just avoided persecution altogether. Once the word was out that the hammer was coming down on the Templars, a lot of them took what treasure they had or whatever they split. They skedaddled to probably safer ground. It's not out of the question to think that the Knights Templars would come running back to the Cistercian monks on an island like Gotland, where they knew they would be safe.
Well, in fact, in the Baltic region, and by the way, there were other orders like the Teutonic Knights that were, just a different Germanic version of the Knights Templar, essentially the same, just a little bit different. But they were would have been the order on Gotland, but they were totally unaffected by this put down order by the Pope and the King of France in 1307. The Templars in the Iberian Peninsula and down into other areas. The major area where the put down was enforced was in France and a little bit in England. So you're talking about a relatively localized area, and the percentage of the total order that was impacted by this put down was probably 10 to maybe 15%. So really, I think there's a misconception about what actually happened and how many of them were affected, but definitely things changed, and they had to make some dramatic alterations, and so the history definitely changed. But to say that the Templars disappeared to history is just simply not true.
So however it happens, it's easy to see, and there are arguments by Templar historians that the Templars were already making visits to the New World. They were already looking for a safe place to go. They knew that, you know, that it was unreliable. Their relationship with Rome at that point was unreliable, and that if they really wanted to continue as an organization, they had to find a place to do it where they could live freely. So again, it comes back to a very interesting argument on whether the Knights Templar or the Teutonic Knights traveled with the Cistercian monks. Perhaps the monks traveled with the Templar organization, and they head off to the New World. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's exactly what happened, in my opinion, to be quite frank. And, you know, this is where we get into a little bit of choppy waters. But, you know, to me, again, as a forensic person, I look at it logically. And, you know, the fundamental thing I think people forget is that the Cistercians or the Templars certainly were a secret organization, definitely after the put down of 1307. I mean, they were literally being hunted down. And so they formed essentially what you could call a secret society with a completely different modus operandi, and they did everything in secret. And so one of the complaints that many people have about the Templars and some of these theories of coming to North America is, well, where's the record? Well, I guess the counter to that would be, well, I wouldn't expect there to be a record. Because of the circumstances, they did this in secret. And the other important point I think that people really don't fully understand or appreciate is that the New World, these guys were opportunists. They were business people, the Cistercians and the Templars. There's no question about that. And there's many facets to what they were about, but they were definitely business people. And you had this whole vast continent that very few people knew about, and it had a tremendous trove of resources, fur, wood, fish, minerals. And, you know, I use the analogy, if you've got a great fishing spot or a great hunting spot, you going to tell anybody about it? So the lack of a record to me makes perfect sense. It doesn't mean that there isn't a record, but the fact that one hasn't been found doesn't prove that it didn't happen. It just proves that you haven't found evidence of it yet. In fact, this stone itself is the record that all that I need, that in fact this theory we're talking about likely is true.
Yeah, it certainly is possible. Have you ever heard of the LaMerica argument about the Knights Templar?
LaMerica. No, flesh it out for me.
That's actually where we have the name. This is, again, choppy waters, but interesting nonetheless, that the Knights Templar are the ones that are responsible for the name America. That it comes from a term they used, LaMerica.
Oh, yes, yes, I have heard of this, yes.
Right, it was simply reduced later on to America, but that this was something that they were pursuing. Now, I don't know of any first-hand scholarship that really proves that one way or another, but I always thought it was an interesting idea, and that this became, especially after the persecution started, the idea of escaping with their treasures to LaMerica and being free of the European feudal system and being able to establish, you know, societies they wanted to, that they took their ship full of treasures, and that's where they headed.
Yes, I think that's exactly, personally, I think that's exactly what happened. And
well, it's an interesting idea anyway.
Yeah.
So, all right, so now people would be saying, but why Minnesota? Oh, it makes sense to say, okay, they came to, you know, the shores of Massachusetts or Virginia or Georgia, whatever. But why Minnesota?
Well, you know, that's kind of been a burning question, and one of the things I've heard for years from opponents is, well, you know, why would they come to Minnesota? Well, there's a number of reasons why you would come to Minnesota. First of all, at that time, in 1362, the Hanseatic League had a blockade of the Baltic region, and so the supply of furs from the Russian fur trade was cut off. So, you know, one of the archaeologists, anthropologists I've talked to, retired Professor Alice Kehoe, really thinks this was one of the primary motivations, again, the economic one, for why they may have come to this region. I mean, the finest furs in North America are right here. So, and of course, you know, hundreds of years later, we have the French here that took advantage of that opportunity. So could there have been a precedence? Did they follow somebody else here? That seems to be a very strong plausibility and a very likely reason. The second thing I think that's very important, something I've been researching lately, is medieval land claim practices. And if you study some of these, there are precedents where if you could establish as an explorer that you had reached the headwaters of a particular watershed and put down a claim, you would be able to then not only claim the land at the headwaters, but the entire watershed and the land associated with it.
And so hang on to that thought.
Okay,
if you put your land claim at the head of the waters, then you get the headwaters and all that flows from it. That is an established land claim method. And that might explain exactly why the Kensington runestone was put right where it is. We'll talk about the geography of that and the geology of the stone itself, which should prove once and for all that this was real and brought here in 14th century, perhaps by the Knights Templar next on Coast to Coast AM. Scott Wolter is the geologist and researcher into the Kensington runestone. We've been talking about it all night. If you're just coming in, go back and listen to it on Streamlink. I think you very much enjoyed this show, as well as last night's show, by the way, too. I thought it was great on that little-known nuclear accident that killed three people back in 1961. So why Kensington, Minnesota? Why would it be if the Cistercians, with the help of the Knights Templar or the Teutonic Knights or whomever it was that were that comprised this this manifest that we have in the Kensington runestone of Swedes and Norsemen that are on this journey, why leave this stone in the middle of a field which would later become a farmer's field in Minnesota?
Well, again, we talked about the idea that furs, which would have been a very prized commodity at that time. They could have been looking for an alternate source for furs.
Sure.
That's one very plausible economic reason. The second would be,
why the land claim there? Why make a land claim right there?
Well, that would be one area there to claim that land, obviously for economic reasons. But the traditions that I've been studying of medieval land practices of some countries was if you could prove that you had navigated a waterway to its headwaters and then placed a land claim, you could then make a claim for not just the waterway but the adjacent land, and so all the way including the entire watershed. And in Kensington, you're talking about the headwaters to both in the general region of the Mississippi and the Missouri, the Minnesota rivers, but also the Red River Valley. So if this is true, in theory, you could say that they laid claim to the entire Mississippi watershed and the Red River Hudson Bay watershed, which is an enormous tract of land. So if that's indeed what they were trying to do, that's a heck of a claim.
I think that's very interesting. I really do. I think that makes a lot of sense. Because otherwise, why the middle of a field? Well, that if you look at the larger picture of where that field is, and it's as it explained in your book, it's a farm that's surrounded by water. I mean, there's rivers and lakes all around that area, and so if you're just trying to say this is ours, our blood is in this ground. Look at all the people that died here. We claim this in the name of us.
That's it. Now, there's more to this story, to this land claim theory, in this area, which I do talk about in a new book I have coming up, and I don't mean to segue off, but, you know, some people are probably saying, well, gee, you got one stone. How do you make that big of a claim? Well, there's more to it than that, but, the bottom line is that the runestone really serves as one of the major pillars are most important pieces to this land claim theory that we're looking into.
Okay. I think that explains a lot. By the way, from where the runestone is, where is the 14-day mark? Where is the 14 days from that point back to the sea? Would that be 14 days back to Lake Superior?
Well, that's a great question. It's one of those puzzling things people have pondered. Now, personally, to me, that makes more sense. And what I understand is the word on the stone that we've translated to sea, the word is havet, and it basically means a body of water large enough to create heave on a boat. And certainly, Lake Superior would fit that description. Now, some people, a researcher, Helmer Holland, who studied the stone for over 50 years, claims that it was the Red River Valley. And then if you go downstream from the headwaters near Kensington, you end up at Lake Winnipeg. Now, that's a possibility, and then you follow the Nelson River to Hudson Bay. That's a very plausible route as well. Now, can you get there in 14 days? I don't know the answer to that, but some people make the claim that you could have. You could certainly get to Lake Superior. So I think those are the two best candidates, at least in my opinion.
If one were walking, one could walk to Lake Superior in 14 days from where they stood on the farm in Kensington, correct?
I think so, but they probably would have traveled by canoes.
Well, that's fine, but I'm just saying that it could have been any of those. There's lots of different explanations, but many different explanations all making sense on how they relate to where they were to where they were going, either by canoe or by foot or whatever.
Yeah, and to fit in context with the message, sure. I mean, the plausibility is just fine.
So either way you look at it, you've got people coming from Scandinavia following the St. Lawrence Seaway or coming in and making various, you know, diversions along the way, ending up there in that place in Minnesota. So, all right, that makes sense. Now, as a geologist, you've looked at the composition of the Kensington runestone, and you, as going back to where we started this conversation originally, in your expertise as a forensic investigator, you say this stone is the real deal.
Well, in my mind, it has to be, and you know, I go back to the kind of the way I explain things in my line of work, that these things are all logic problems, and really, if you look at them as logic problems, it makes things a lot easier. And in my mind, you know, you've got two sides to this story. It's either a late 19th century hoax perpetrated by Olaf Ullmann or someone in the community, or it's not. Really, the only other plausible explanation is that it is what it says it is, a 14th century document. So that's kind of the way I approached it. And what I looked at, and if you want me to describe, you know, the geological work I did, I could probably sum it up pretty quick.
Yeah, let's do that, just because that's your expertise. Give us a minute or two
on that. Okay, sure. Well, we did a number of things, and one of the things that we do in our business before we can even begin to start the work is we have to know what we're starting with. And to do that, we need to take invasive samples. And in the case of the Kinsey and the Runestone, I took a small core sample, an inch diameter by 2 inches long, core sample out of the back of the stone, and we made thin sections, and we identified what the rock was. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do this with one of my former professors from University of Minnesota Duluth, Dick Ojukangas, and I really appreciate his help. But we identified the rock as a Precambrian-aged metagraywacke. And what that is a sandstone that's been cooked and heated geologically over millions of years. What was nice about that is that it created it's got a lot of different minerals in it, some that weather quickly, some that weather slowly, and it gave me a lot of minerals to choose from to try to figure out what the weathering of the inscription was. And, of course, the question that everybody wanted to know from me was not how old the stone is. Of course, the stone is very old. But how old is the inscription? And incidentally, I think a very important point here that we need to say right from the get-go is that Dick Ojukangas and I concluded that this stone is indigenous to Minnesota, probably came from the Anamiki Basin, which is up near the Cuyuna Iron Range in Minnesota. And so it's consistent with glacial flow lines that this rock was likely carried from that area into the Kensington area, and the Kensington party that carved it found this rock, split it down to the final shape that we see and carved the inscription. So that's just some basic information, but that's important because a lot of people have asked me, well, could they have brought the stone with them from Scandinavia? And the answer is no.
No, and there wouldn't have been any purpose for it, probably.
Well, it would have been a big job. Why do that when it would have been easier just to take a local stone?
And this thing weighs a couple hundred pounds.
Yes.
Okay.
So you
wouldn't be throwing in your canoe and portaging it either. I mean, this is the kind of thing you find it and you carve on it, and that's much more in the tradition of the way a lot of the runes are anyway. It's you carve what's there and making it serve your purpose instead of bringing one with you like you would stationary.
It just doesn't make sense to do it the other way. It makes sense to use local material. I agree with that.
Okay, so we can establish that geologically it's there. Linguistically, we now know that it was written in a very specific dialect that only goes back to one particular place in Scandinavia in these runes. So what is it? How does this change the way we look at history? What are we rethinking if everything we've said is true?
Well, I think it's really not a small point at all. It's a huge point. And what it means is that the established history that we have been told, I know you and I are probably similar in age, and Columbus discovered America. And, you know, that's what everybody was taught. Now, Launce of Meadows, which is a Norse Viking settlement area up in Canada along the eastern coastline there, changed that premise forever. And I think sometimes people forget that. But I really think that it opens the door to a whole new interpretation of history prior to Christopher Columbus. Now, it's not the subject of the discussion tonight, but I will tell you that there are hundreds of artifacts and sites in this continent, pre-Columbian sites, that need to be studied. Now, when I say pre-Columbian, they appear to be pre-Columbian. What they are at this point is unknown. But the way they've been treated by modern scholars, historians, archaeologists, in my opinion, is reprehensible, to be quite honest. And as a scientist, I look at these things and I say, okay, they need to be studied. Because if, there's any chance that they could possibly be what we think they are, pre-Columbian artifacts, it's vitally important to the history of this country. This artifact alone changes the paradigm in a profound way. And I guess it boils down to this, Ian, is that if standard academics were wrong about the Kensington Runestone, what else were they wrong about?
Right. And that, you know, I think most people are good with the idea that we all, that, you know, Columbus wasn't the first Westerner, that there's lots of evidence about all the different groups that have come here and touched North America other than the Native Americans that were here. I think this stone makes a much stronger argument than for some of these other things that you speak of, like the famous carving of a knight in New England, that seemed to imply that knights had been here and that other things had happened, that it's like, okay, well, the more that these things pop up, the more we have to say these trade winds were blowing here with many more ships a lot earlier than anybody really was willing to say before. And in such a volume, and this is another example, that they would have probably been following along somebody else's map that says here, go here. Exactly. You know, I mean, that they weren't necessarily the first ones either, just because they left the earliest evidence.
Well, isn't that interesting how when you delve into things like this, that you find somebody did something, but most often the case is they followed somebody before them. And all I know is that I just want to know what happened. I think Americans and people in general, are able to handle the truth. There were political reasons for why something like the Kensington Runestone would not have been convenient to be legitimate, especially when we were first laying out our country and claiming land. To have somebody else coming here would not have been politically expedient. So it's a complicated story, but I think the time is perfect now to come out with the truth, and let's examine it, and it is what it is. We can handle it.
And I think it's interesting. I mean, this is sort of a Minnesota thing, but, you know, here on this stone where it specifies essentially Swedes and Norwegians working together to do this, which – it may be the last time Swedes and Norwegians work together on anything in Minnesota, but the level of cooperation, the interest, I think it's fascinating, and I think that there may still be pieces then out there. For example, if we can find Cistercian shipping records, whether there is where they have a record of a ship having come back about this time from a long journey, and whether there's anything that they brought back with them that would have been helpful to the Cistercian monks, you know, or did they send out other, if the Kensington Runestone's true, then, and I believe it is, then what other runes might they find in Canada or other places where the Cistercians might have also been traveling that previous to this hadn't gotten consideration?
Well, stay tuned, Ian, because there are plenty of artifacts. There are other rune stones. There are structures. And these are some of the things that, and I don't want to be a shameless plugger here, but I
plug do away.
Have a
That's
brand
the next
new book,
book
coming out that discusses all of this.
Okay. And this would establish then a larger and more frequent visits from this group.
No question about it.
Okay. These are stones that had existed and also not been able to be translated before the discovery of this old runic language?
Yes. Again, these things were confusing to modern scholars, and again, you know, the same problems they had with the Kensington Runestone. But I can say this, there are five runestones found in North America that are clearly connected, one of those being the Kensington Runestone, is unquestionably that link them to the same group of people we've been talking about. Hmm. And this really becomes the focal point of this new research that I've been doing. And I'll tell you what, I mean, all kidding aside, it is just amazing. It's incredible. And I think that the evidence from multiple disciplines, including history, language, geology, is consistent with the premise that we're talking about tonight. So
yep. I think
fascinating story.
I think it is. I think one of the reasons why I'd heard it dismissed, too, the Kensington Rune story, is because of this mistake, and you alluded to it, of people thinking that, well, here are all these Swedes and Norwegians, and they want to pretend that Vikings had been here before. It was part of their folklore. Yeah. But again, if we're talking about the 14th century, we're not talking about Vikings. Right?
Exactly. I mean, and the term Viking implies that they were pagans or non-Christians, and that you know, carries a lot of things with it. This is Christian times. There's no question about it, and the evidence is on the stone. Once you understand and realize what these people were about, how their minds worked, or how you think their minds worked, once you look at it in that context, you see a whole set of different things which clearly indicates that it's a Christian document, no question about it.
That's fascinating. And I guess I would properly, we'd have to change the name of the team to the Minnesota Cistercians.
No, the Minnesota Templars.
Well, that'd be cool. I think that would be cool. But and the Templar connection is interesting. And I think that we start going down a road that, while I really love, it's compelling to think that the Templars were involved. On any of the rune stones that you have found, is there any specific reference to the Templars on any of the other runes that you've come across?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and really it's a complicated discussion, but it's on the rune stone and it's on these other stones that clearly suggest, and I think the word that we probably want to use moving forward, Ian, is Templarism.
Okay. A Templar-like.
Well, Templarism, which refers to a mindset or a philosophy, and that's probably more accurate, I guess.
Okay.
But Templars is okay, too, I guess.
All right. Well, that's just where we'll leave it until you jump in the conversation. Now the phones are already ringing. We'll give you the numbers that you need for your question, your comment, to Scott Walter, the forensic geologist and the co-author of The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. We'll get to your questions and comments coming up next. Go online, take a look at the pictures. You get a better idea of what we're talking about at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Ponet. All right, so where do we start? Let's go with the person who's been hanging on the longest. That's CS, East of the Rockies, on Coast to Coast AM for Scott Walter, the co-author of The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. You can get a copy of it by going to our webpage. Hey, CS.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Hi, Walter. Hi. Did you say that you are a geologist?
Yes, sir.
Oh, wow. Great. Well, I'm surprised to not hear anything in what I've heard so far from you that this stone could have been geologically deposited where it was found and that it was not found upright and also that it was found on a hill. And my third question is...
I don't understand how that's a question. What's the question?
Was the stone geologically deposited by a glacier?
Yes.
Glacially deposited?
Yes.
That's what he said earlier.
He actually said that?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I must have missed that.
So
do you think it was further south and brought north, or you think it was further north and brought south by a glacier, or could it have ebbed and flowed many times?
Well, we didn't have glacial transport south to north. The only direction you have is roughly north to south. And the geology or the provenance of this rock geologically is from a place called the Animiki Basin sediments that are Precambrian in age from up near the Cuyuna Iron Range. That's where we think it originated. And if you look at the glacial flow lines, it would have been very reasonable to have it end up in Kensington after, the Pleistocene period. So it was definitely indigenous to Minnesota.
It would have traveled
southwest
from where it would have been.
Right.
Okay. Mark is in Little Rock, Arkansas on Coast to Coast AM. Mark?
Hey, good evening, guys.
Hi, Mark.
I do have a question, and then I'll make a comment after that. Has it been possible to see if there were little fragments of the knife or the chisel used to make the inscriptions inside the runes? Are there any flakes or any type of media that could be stated?
That's a good question, and it's a question that's been posed by many people over the decades, and certainly was something that I looked for during my microscopic study. I did not see any evidence of any remnants that were left behind. Having said that, I guess I'm not surprised by that, because one of the things that I found out during my subsequent investigation of the history of the stone since its discovery was that it's had a very unique history. At one point in 1937, when casts were made of the stone for the University of Minnesota, there were plaster casts that were made, and to clean it, they used engine oil and ether. And so it's been cleaned any number of times. And if you recall, I mentioned that Olaf Ullmann said he took a nail and cleaned out the inscription and actually scratched the bottom of the runes, and therefore gave it a relatively fresh-looking appearance, which confused many investigators and is another part of this problem. So unfortunately, no remnants have been found.
Or it would have been cross-pollinated, if you will, with the iron from the nail. So if they had found some nail sediment, there was no way of knowing which iron or what was used as the chisel, because it could have been from the nail or from whatever was used originally to carve it. You had a quick comment then?
No, I don't know. That's okay.
All right, very good. Let's go ahead and go to next is Lake Stevens, Washington, for Gina on Coast to Coast AM. Gina?
Hi. How you all doing?
Good.
Yeah, God bless you all first. I found one of these tablets with writing on it here in the state of Washington. I don't know if it's a rune stone or if it's a Celtic tablet, but I found it last year when I was out treasure hunting with some friends, and the other treasures we were coming out with were Indian treasures, and we had too much weight and everything else. We were running out of daylight, and we could not grab this treasure. I've been waiting almost a year to go and get it, and in about 3-4 weeks, I get to go get the treasure because my friend remembers exactly where we had to leave it behind.
Well, if I could make a suggestion,
this is very
interesting. Don't clean it.
I would say what you might want to do is just hold off on removing it unless you think it's in, imminent danger of somebody else finding it, because context is very important. And, you know, that's one of the problems that has been surrounding many of these artifacts, is they get removed by people who innocently think they're preserving something, but archaeologists correctly argue that once you remove something from its original site, the site is compromised. So what I would suggest is first of all, go back and take some photographs. You might want to go even after dark, use a flashlight or a lantern or something to cast the light at a low angle across the face so you can highlight what's there. And if you want to send me some photographs, I can tell you what the script is, and I certainly have access to many experts who know a lot more than me about different scripts. We might be able to help you, not only decipher it, but give you some advice as to what to do next.
Okay, because if it was Celtic, it was possibly the language of Ogham, is what I found out.
Well, that's the linear type of script, and Ogham would be a series of lines, mostly vertical. So that's what Ogham would be. But, it sounds like you might have something that needs to be studied. And
yeah. Wouldn't it be better
to handle it properly?
How
do I get a hold of you? I was going to just, film getting it, you know what I mean? But how do I get a hold of you?
Well, Ian, isn't my email and website I'll give it to you if you want.
No, just you can.
I don't have access. Well, I don't have a computer, but I guess I could go to somebody who has one. But what is that email address? I don't know if it's an 800 number as well. But
okay. Well, my email is swolter.
Okay.
AmEngTest.com.
This is why I say better off get to a friend's computer and link up to him through coasttocoastam.com and take it from there. And or Gina, too, the other thing you could do is you could always contact a local university or college where somebody
I would be careful with that.
Why do you say that?
Well, because you have to remember something. There are many people today, I don't want to get into too sticky waters, that will tell you if you find something like this, they will immediately dismiss it and without even looking at it. As crazy as that sounds, believe me, that is what often happens. So
let's do Steve in Virginia then on Coast to Coast AM, wildcard line for Scott Walter, author of the Kensington Runestone. Steve?
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. First thing you said was the first thing on the stone was an 8.
Yes.
Well, that probably means there's at least seven more of those stones.
Well, you bring up a great point, and I'll just throw one quick little thing out to you. The stone was clearly intentionally carved and broken down from a larger slab. There have been no fragments or any other pieces of the stone found. The question is, where's the rest of it?
Yeah.
So that's a possibility, that opens up a whole nother interesting bunch of stuff.
Well, but you do suspect that there are other runestones connected to this Kensington runestone, even in that area. They just haven't been found yet.
I don't know that to be true in our area here in Minnesota, I suspect that it is. But there are other stones that have been found on the East Coast that are clearly connected to the Kensington Runestone.
All right, very good. We'll wait for that new book then, right?
Yeah.
John is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast AM for Scott Walter. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Scott. I'd like to know, if you look at all the Native American traditions, can you find any evidence of white legends or so forth to corroborate this?
Well, you know what? That's another great question. And one of the things we haven't talked about is the Native American connection. And personally, I believe that the Templarism that we were talking about earlier is an ideology that's fundamental to this whole thing. And what I mean by that is that I believe that the belief systems that these people embraced would have been compatible with Native Americans. In other words, I don't believe they fought their way to Kensington. I believe they traveled with them. And therefore, I believe that we have a tremendous opportunity to approach Native Americans in a respectful way and try to see if maybe we can glean something from them. I personally have no doubt in my mind that they could be very helpful. I have talked to some Native American elders, and they have some very interesting things to say. Obviously, there are some issues that need to be addressed regarding Native Americans, but I don't blame them for some of their positions, but there's an opportunity there, and I think we need to take advantage of it. We'll probably learn a lot. That's a great point.
So his specific point is, had you heard from anybody who said, yes, according to our legend, there were white travelers who came here speaking a funny language and carving on stones
yes.
in the 14th
century? Yes, I have.
Okay.
Yes,
all
I
right.
have. That's more than once.
Dave is in Madisonville, Kentucky on Coast to Coast. Dave?
Yes, good evening. Ian, thanks for taking my call. You're my favorite host.
Oh, you're very nice. Thank you.
I was finding the connection to Templars to be a little tenuous. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that based on the use of the language, that particular dialect?
No. The dialect is unique to Gotland and other
right.
specific regions within Scandinavia. The Templar connection comes really started for me with the Cistercians. And then when I started to delve into the history of the Cistercians, the Templars were obviously part of that organization. And then, you know, you start to get into some of the practical issues. How would they have traveled, and how would they have done that? And the Templars certainly begin to play a prominent role. And the more I studied the history of the relationship of the Cistercians and the Templars after post-1307, and the timing here is also very interesting, 1362, and when you begin to look at what the possibilities are, this became ever more intriguing. And there's a lot more to this whole Templar thing that we haven't discussed tonight. But if I could just make one point that I personally have found rather puzzling, is that when I began to talk about Templars and Cistercians, which to me seemed perfectly reasonable and plausible and, quite frankly, the only candidates that made any sense, some of the people I talked to in the academic community became, they just turned their nose up. And what I've found is that for some reason, when you start talking about Templars, it's almost like academic porn to many people. And I just really, quite frankly, don't understand it. To me, they are far and away the most plausible candidates, the timing, the history and everything else, the stone. We really don't have anybody else that fits the profile better than them. And, I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Well, there were other reasons for young Norsemen to be coming over to America.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, that wouldn't necessarily be connected with the Templars or the Church. Just the fact that only the eldest son would inherit. Wouldn't the younger sons to go out and try and find their own place in the world?
Well, you make a good point there, and most of the younger sons were incorporated into these monastic orders because they didn't have other options as far as inheritance goes. And you have to remember, if you go back to medieval times, it was a tough time. Life was hard, and by joining these monastic orders, one of the things that was just a plain reality that made it very attractive is you had a place to sleep, you had food, and you had a job to do. You had purpose. So, and you can't underscore how important religion was at that time. So you had a very attractive venue for these second, third sons, if you will, to join these orders and become Templars.
I'll echo Dave's point a little bit, because I think, I really like I love the science and the solid research and all of the footwork that you did right up to the point where it would be, almost seems like a dead lock that it's the Cistercians that would have been the ones that would have been writing on this tablet. That makes all the sense. They were the educated clergy of this island. It's a high bet that they would be in a group that would be traveling off of the island too. The Templar part's interesting because, certainly the Knights Templar it was known in their tradition that they had traveled to the New World. There's other evidence that says that Templar ships would have touched the New World somewhere, whether it's up further up in Canada or further down the Eastern Shore. But I do think that it gets into a weird area when if you start thinking of the Cistercians and the Templars as being completely compatible, because I do think the Knights Templar, I think a lot of people turn their nose up at the Knights Templar piece, if I were to be so bold,
sure,
is because there's a lot of things that get projected onto the Knights Templar that has no primary source material connected to it. So especially when it comes to all of the Da Vinci Code stuff, people love to speculate about the Knights Templar, and it's all very sexy. It's really hard to find any primary source that says any of it is true.
Well, you're right about that, but at the same time, this falls under the category of a lack of evidence doesn't prove anything. It doesn't mean that it's not true, and I'm not saying that that means that it is true, but the point is it remains an open question. So a lot of these aspects are still on the table, and because of that, there is a relative lack of documentation. For some people, it's hard to swallow, and I can appreciate that. But I think that there are other motivations, multiple motivations of why people in general do anything. And when you look at this question, certainly the economic principles we've talked about or motivations were there.
Right.
Claiming land is there. But I
right.
think there's another aspect here that we need to think about, and that is the religious aspect and the motivation of what, if we're talking about the Templars, does it make sense? I think it does. They were persecuted for their religious belief systems, and I think that standard historians' interpretation of what the Templars believed, and the Cistercians for that matter, might not be correct.
I think that's the difference.
And that's subject to debate.
Well, I guess the debate is, I'm very interested in the Da Vinci Code. I've traveled the route of the Da Vinci Code. I've been in every single building of every scene in the Da Vinci Code, save the Roslyn Chapel, which I had to fly back just before the group went there. But I know a lot about that. And I think that there are just so many things that have been stapled onto the back of the Knights Templar that was not originally part of their worldview. And it's become, it's sort of taken on a life of its own, almost like an accepted truth. So I understand why that part gets a colder reaction from academia. I think up until you get into that whole Knights Templar thing, I think this is like an absolute 100% lock. I think you are, and the Knights Templar connection may be true, but it starts to become sort of an uneasy alliance to think of the Templars and the Cistercians as agreeing with, on, for example, even on Christianity. But let's put that aside for the time being and get back for more questions and comments coming up next half hour. Lots of people hanging on. For Scott Walter, the Kensington Rune Stone. We'll give you the numbers if you need it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Back to the phones where Calvin is in North Carolina on Coast to Coast AM. Calvin?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, you're talking with Scott Walter.
Hi, Calvin.
Hi, Ian. How you doing?
Terrific. Thank you. Go ahead, Calvin.
I would like to know, what do you know about rune stones in Ethiopia at Axum?
Wow. The answer is I don't know anything about them, but you piqued my curiosity. But I will say this, nothing would surprise me. So if you say they're there, I'm sure they might very well be.
You know, a couple of months ago, okay, before I started doing my work, because I make tombstones and memorial stones.
Oh, cool.
And there was an episode on the History Channel. They were talking about Axum, and what was so strange about it was a painting of the Virgin Mary and Jesus on there, and right beside the painting was, on the left side, was a symbol of a rune stone, and other lettering that was in there was of rune stones. And it was kind of strange because other lettering was like, I guess you could say it was like, almost like a broken language, I guess, you know.
Maybe a mixture of things.
You know, I got online and I did some research, and I've discovered that this painting in Axum is at least 1700 B.C., you know, I mean.
Wait. A painting of Jesus and the Virgin the Virgin Mary, 1700 B.C.?
B.C., exactly. It's so strange because the history there in Ethiopia has been buried.
You know what? If I could just jump in for a second.
Sure.
It may not seem as crazy as you think, Ian, because the depiction of the Virgin Mary.
I know where you're going with this.
Okay,
we're going to get into the whole ISIS mystery cult thing.
Possible.
No. If it's Jesus and the Virgin Mary, 1700 B.C., not. But if you're talking about, is this a proto image from some of the early mystery cults, especially in Ethiopia, where the heavy emphasis on mathematics and geometry, that's
right.
Not terribly surprising. But that's different. If it's ISIS we're talking about, or a version of that, that's different than this. So. Virgin Mary, Jesus, no, but if it could have been an ISIS image, yeah, sure, that's very plausible.
And that's where I was going.
Right.
Yeah.
Let me get to Mike in Nevada on Coast to Coast for Scott Walter. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, guys. Very interesting show. I'd like to make a comment about Columbus and then three quick references to pre-Columbian visitations. First of all, Columbus is revered as discovering the New World because he's the European we can go back to successfully lead colonization of the New World. So anything prior to that is discounted. Now, first example of a pre-Columbian visitation, up and down the west coast of North and South America, there are stones from ballast stones from Chinese and Japanese fishing ships that are all up and down the west coast in shallow water, showing that they visited there fishing expeditions. Second one, I remember some Discovery show showing a graves uncovered there in Minnesota in your backyard of large red-haired Caucasians, Vikings, from the you know, that era. And then the third one I came across when I was doing a research paper in college on comparative religions, and I came across a chapter in a book about the Vatican has records of established parishes and branches in Iceland, Greenland, and Vinland, and they have tithing records from the 1100 to 1200 range AD from Vinland and Greenland, but those dwindled and died out as the settlements died out. So if you could maybe research Vatican tithing records, you might be able to establish pre-Columbian link there with the Norwegians and the Vikings.
That's interesting. Yeah,
I like it a lot.
Bruce is in Carefree, Arizona on Coast to Coast AM for Scott Walter, author of the Kensington Runestone. Bruce?
Hi, Ian. Scott?
Hi, Bruce.
I was kind of concerned here about the settlers moving west in the early days came across non-Indian peoples living in Western-style homes in the Appalachian Mountains. There was a book out on it several years ago. And that it's kind of spinned over, as a lot of things like that are. But I always, in my mind, I sort of associated the disappearance of the Knights Templar and their treasure, and then their the phenomenal engineering that went into the Oak Island thing, and then these people that were living in Europe. And I sort of put it in my mind, my own mind, that they were moving from, some of the Knights Templar escaped with their treasure. They buried it on Oak Island, and then they set up a society here in the Appalachian Mountains. Can you comment on that or tie any of the runestones together to that?
Well, in a general sense, I think that there's a lot of research out there that would be consistent with that. There's pieces of information in many different areas that would suggest that that's true. As far as Oak Island goes, I've been to Oak Island, and I'm not sold that there's a Templar treasure there. I'm not sure what that is, but I'm not convinced of Oak Island. But I use the term Templarism, make it to North America prior to Columbus and then after Columbus and establish a foothold in the New World? I think there's a lot of evidence that would support that, yes.
Stephen is in Bellingham, Washington, on Coast to Coast AM for Scott Walter. Go ahead.
Hi, Stephen. Gentlemen. How are you?
Hi.
I had a question about, if you had any knowledge of the Greek sailors' etchings that were found in a cave, I believe it was near St. Louis. And also, I wanted to bring up the Great Mound of Ohio, the snake.
Yep.
Serpent
mounds, yeah.
Yeah, 1,254 feet long, and if these things tie into, some proofs that there were European settlers here in the pre-Columbian age.
Well, yes, I'm familiar with what you're talking about down in southern Illinois. I think you're referring to what is commonly known as Burroughs Cave. I have done a little bit of work on the artifacts from the cave, and at this point what I can tell you is I haven't seen any red flags yet. That doesn't mean that the cave is real. In fact, I can tell you that there's no way I'm going to be able to definitively say one thing or another until I'm able to see if there is indeed a cave, get into this cave, and perform some testing. And then, but at that point, if there is a cave and there's artifacts and reportedly remains, the question will be answered anyway. So that remains an open question. I don't really have an opinion on that. But it's interesting, and there's all kinds of other sites, serpent mounds, things that have been found inside Native American burials that suggest early pre-Columbian contact that would make the people that carved the Kensington Runestone Johnny-come-latelys, to say the least.
Jeannie is in San Jose on Coast to Coast AM at a wildcard line for Scott Walter. Jeannie?
Yes. Hi, Scott. I wanted to make a comment. I think maybe Ian may have brushed across it. It was the Roslyn Chapel.
Yes.
There are some very interesting stonework in Roslyn Chapel. It looks like they've actually been to the Americas when they were carving those
stones.
I've been to Roslyn Chapel a couple of times, and what you're referring to is the maize carvings and the aloe leaves in a couple of the windows, and the aloe is over one of the archways. That's very interesting, and I think that's a good point. How did they learn about that? Some people have talked about seeing evidence of corn or maize in Egyptian carvings, which would obviously predate Roslyn, but one thing I can tell you is that there appears to be a very strong connection of a carving in Roslyn that would be a direct connection to the Kensington runestone. And I'll just leave it at that. It was previously unknown, but it's something that we discovered and is compelling, to say the least. Doesn't prove anything at the moment, but we're looking into this connection, and Roslyn's a very interesting place and does, in my opinion, play a role in this story.
Are there any specific runes in Roslyn? Are there any of the that would have tied them to the Cistercians, or any of the, you know, for any reason why any of the early old Swedish would have been used at Roslyn?
Not in a sense of the runic inscriptions. But one of the key symbols, in fact, the key symbol, the hooked X,
mm-hmm.
which is being used for the A sound. And it's kind of interesting. I gave a lecture last Thursday, and there was a person that attended my lecture who commented on that symbol when I talked about it and brought up a possible Hebrew connection. I thought that was very interesting, something we've looked at, but definitely needs to be explored. But
Scott,
that's the symbol
Scott, that
found
was,
at
that,
Roslyn.
That was me.
That
was me.
You were at that talk?
Yeah, that was me. And I said it's the Hebrew Aleph. It's me.
Well, you know what, Ian? That was a very insightful question, and that told me a lot about you.
Okay.
And it's
okay.
It told me a lot of good things.
Okay, there you go. All right. Chris is in Utah on Coast to Coast AM for Scott Walter. Go ahead, Chris.
Hello, great show, Scott and Ian. I just wondered if you were aware of that article they put out in Frontier Times, 1964, in August and September.
Which article?
It was wrote by David Beckerman. He had a deal in there about all the six different graves they found with swords and steel, you know, metal artifacts. They're Scandinavian. And then it talks about mainly the Mandan Indians and how they spoke that peculiar dialect with the Sioux dialect with the interspersed with Scandinavian words all through it. And
this is totally cool.
I am aware of this.
Yeah.
And these are great points. You got great callers here. I love this. But the Mandan Indians, which is basically an extinct race or essentially extinct race
Mohawk.
Now, carries many potential Norse traits, physical, and they built longhouse-type structures and language, of course. And it's not just the Mandans. This language connection is found in other Native American cultures and is something that needs to be investigated further. I mean, the whole paradigm of this thing being a hoax is really done at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And once people start to look at these different aspects, I guarantee you they will find a lot of things.
Now, that's a very interesting article. And what year was that, Chris, and what?
It was 1964 in August and September, and that they had several articles, other deals about the French. The governor of Canada, and he commissioned a commission to go down there and solve the mystery because they were convinced back then in 1738.
Yeah,
and
that's
Champlain in 1816. Even commented on it.
Yep.
The U.S. Department of Indian Affairs stated that the Mandans were a whole different from all their Indian groups.
No question about it. You're
very
right.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. All right, so Michael in British Columbia on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, you're talking with Scott Walter at Kensington Runestone.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I used to live on a very remote community on the west coast of B.C., and I was watching a BBC documentary, and they were showing some petroglyphs on the east coast of China, and they showed a figure, just very quickly. Anyways, that exact same face is on the west coast of BC, and it's the Newhawk who carved these don't even know, actually, they don't even know who carved them. They're so old, the carvings on in D.C. And the other one's in China, and the documentary said they're 7,000 years old. And I'm just wondering if anyone's ever picked up.
Well, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
Yeah, because one of the old-timers that lived there in the valley, he always claimed that he knew of some copper mines with Chinese symbols. And he always, and I always just kind of brushed them off, you know, like, oh. So
right.
Whether or not there's anything to this, but he was always adamant that he knew where the Chinese were over here thousands of years ago on the West Coast.
Well, I tell you what, if there was pre-Columbian contact on the East Coast of North America, why wouldn't there be pre-Columbian contact on the West side?
Yeah.
To me, it's like it's perfectly reasonable, and here's just another example of something that appears to be legitimate or possibly legitimate and should be investigated. I don't have any problem with it.
Yeah, I think again, if you go online at coasttocoastam.com and look at the photographs of the Kensington runestone, there's a piece to this, too, that I wanted to mention before our time ran away, and that is the geometry of the runestone. And you think it's really significant.
Yeah.
Obviously, the piece of stone is bigger than they needed,
yeah.
But the stone itself is consistent with the 2-to-1 sacred geometry.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's really an interesting idea that even in that's similar to what would have been connected, you know, traditionally to the Knights Templar.
Yeah.
I thought, okay,
that's another fact that happens to be consistent with
right.
the premise we're discussing. Doesn't prove it, but
right.
it's consistent. And, you know, what we're talking about here is are there enough of these consistencies, factual pieces of data that are consistent with one idea versus another? I mean, that's the way we build a case in science, and
right.
there's a lot more that we could talk about, and hopefully we'll get a chance to do that. But that's a great observation, Ian. It's a very interesting point.
Can we go to Jason? Is there anybody on the first time caller line that it just didn't show up on my screen? Oh, let's get Doug in the Bronx because he's been waiting the longest.
Okay.
Then. For Scott Walter, that he may be our last call, depending on how long this takes. Go ahead, Doug.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I wanted to go back to some basic information about Gotland.
Yeah.
Exactly where is it?
It's right in the middle of the Baltic Sea, and, you know, there's a lot of things I could say about Gotland, but another interesting point is that it was the center of trade, and there were all kinds of cultures that were interacting there, and we do see some interesting influence on the stone, for example, the Germanic influence in the form of the umlaut. So it's right in the middle of the Baltic Sea. It was a part of Sweden back then in the 14th century, and it is part of Sweden today.
Okay. See, what I don't understand is when the farmer made out his copy of the inscription,
yes,
and brought it to the University of Minnesota, why wouldn't the professor there have been able to recognize a language, if he really was a professor of Scandinavian languages? There's no reason why he shouldn't, especially since this stone is
Christian.
Yes, there is a reason. The reason is that the corpus of information on Gotland had not been studied yet. It's a unique body of runic information. It wasn't known in 1898, and they didn't even begin to study it until the 1960s. So that professor had no chance to figure this out.
It's all in the book. I have to say, I mean, I think it's a solid case, page to page. It's the Kensington Runestone, compelling new evidence. Link up to Scott Walter at coasttocoastam.com. Go from there, send an email, and let him know if you have any runestones in your backyard, too. I know you're collecting them from all over the country.
Look forward
to hearing more about the new book when that comes out, okay?
Ian, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. This was a lot of fun.
Good. Enjoyed the conversation quite a bit. Thanks for your openness, too. And in the meantime, keep a thought out for the folks in South Dakota. They're not out of the river yet with this flood, even on the western part of Minnesota. Deus te amat, and I do too.